For this year's favorite books, we have our normal panel, and they're going to go in the order in which they have to leave on this Boxing Day, the 26th of December, 2011. I've just gotten over some severe antibiotic response, so my mind is not working too well. I'll be the last to speak. I might not speak at all today. I might add my thoughts later. The members of the panel are, as usual, John Dederich, Allison Jones-Pomato, and Cameron Codlin. They'll talk in that order, and we'll throw in our comments as we see fit. John?
Thanks, Eric. Well, it was kind of a Shakespearean year for me, being in and directing The Tempest early in the year. Then I directed Richard III at the end of the year. So I was reading lots of Shakespeare, and the first thing I'd like to talk about is a new biography of Shakespeare by Peter Ackroyd. Ackroyd's one of my favorite authors. He's written the definitive biography of Charles Dickens, a great biography of William Blake, lots of really interesting novels, lots of literary criticism, a biography of the City of London, which is well worth checking out. His biography of Shakespeare is extremely well researched, and I like very much that he... although he doesn't directly take on the Edward de Vere, Earl of Oxford controversy, what he does is that he looks at correspondences in the text. He actually goes to the text. How's that for a novel idea? Goes to the text of the plays and looks at all the references to Warwickshire, where Stratford is, and all the references to the types of industry and husbandry that would have been known to someone from that area. And also the connections that are obvious in the plays with Shakespeare's family. On his mother's side, the Ardens, who were a notoriously Catholic family at the time. If you really want to get a more... There's a lot of speculation. Let me just interject that. Because there needs to be a lot of speculation. Because there's not a lot of biographical data about the man named William Shakespeare. Now, this is not news. This is known. But there's speculation and there's fancy, and I think that intelligent speculation goes a long way as opposed to fancy. If you're at all interested in Shakespeare or the 16th century or theater, this is a great read. Ackroyd is a terrific writer. It reads very well. There's nothing dry about it, and I highly recommend that. I also read a book called My Name is Will, which is by Jess Sanfield. The subtitle of My Name is Will is a novel of sex, drugs, and Shakespeare. And it's just fun, rollicking good fun, but it's also extremely well-researched good fun, where the setting is 1980s. The protagonist who narrates the novel is a student at UC Santa Cruz, and that should immediately open up doors of imagination in your mind about what can go on at UC Santa Cruz in the 80s. And his name is William Shakespeare. Figure that. I forget his last name, the character, but his first name is William Shakespeare. He's a graduate student. It goes in really odd directions. It goes back and forth between the present of the novel, which is the 80s, and the life of William Shakespeare. So it's My Name is Will goes back and forth between their protagonists in their young early 20s and both Stratford in the 1580s and Santa Cruz in the 80s. It's really a lot of fun. I really recommend it. It's very entertaining. The portrait of young William Shakespeare, as in 1580s William Shakespeare, is, I think, fun and yet well-researched. Doesn't contradict anything that we know of that what little that we do know. It's really, really a lot of fun. The next Shakespearean jaunt is a book called Will, which I'm not recommending. I didn't really like it. It thinks it's clever. There's a pun in the title because the framing sequence is Shakespeare on his deathbed, dictating the notorious will, that the will of the second best bed to his wife and the notebooks, etc., that people know about. And then it goes into great lengths to sort of, as he's reminiscing on his deathbed about all what these various things mean, and it's just sloppy is what it is. And I'm not recommending it. It says, this book is about 10 or 15 years old, and it says, soon to be a major motion picture by Ben Kingsley, and that never happened, so that tells you something right there. The Book of Aaron Shadows by Michael Gruber, terrific book, really fun. It evolves around a supposed Shakespearean manuscript. There is no such thing. There is no manuscript. That is a handwritten copy of any Shakespearean work, and it's a Shakespearean manuscript of a new unknown play about Mary, Queen of Scots, who would have been certainly a hot topic during the period where he's writing plays. She who was beheaded by the current queen, Elizabeth the First, and of course is the mother of the king, King James. And it's supposed to expose the absolute Catholicism of William Shakespeare, which is, again, an interesting topic for that scholars are looking at, is the relative Protestant Catholicism of William Shakespeare. This is a really fun book. It's, again, I think, very well researched. It really looks a lot at evidence in the life, evidence in the text, and also deals with the whole issue of international book trade, book thievery, ancient manuscripts. It's just fun. The author's name is Michael Gruber. I think he's primarily a writer of mysteries. And this is a mystery of sorts, but it, I think it transcends the genre, as though you need to. You don't need to. I hate this whole distinction between literary fiction and genre fiction. It's the phony distinction if there ever was one. Where do you put, you know, Victor Hugo or Edgar Allan Poe, for example? And then the last book I want to talk about is one of my favorite authors, Haruki Murakami. His book is called 1Q84. And it is, if you're familiar with Murakami, then you know that he goes well off into uncharted territory, that there's a surreal aspect of his novel. What is interesting to me is that he's able to work this extraordinary tension between, on the one hand, which is a very graphic and plain realism. There's a realistic development of character. There's a great descriptive detail of the world as we commonly agree it to be. And then the flip side of that is there is this alternate reality. And this, in everything I've read, there's an element of that. And more so in this, there's a complete alternate reality where someone slips from the year 1984, which is again where this novel is set, into this alternate reality, which the protagonist of the novel calls 1Q84. It deals with religious cults. It's very hard on Jehovah's Witnesses. It deals with a kind of cult that is reminiscent of, you might remember a few years ago, there was this the nerve gas mass murder attack on, I think it was the Tokyo subway. And it doesn't deal with it by name, but looks at a similar kind of cult with similar kind of dark designs.
And you know that Murakami wrote a book about those attacks.
Exactly, I was going to say. Yeah, I think he was quite an expert on that that cult and what they were about, and I think he's drawn on that experience and that research as one of the underpinnings in 1Q84, which gives it a kind of contemporary relevance. But doesn't need relevance because it's just a hell of a good book. He's a really great writer. It's very involved. It's a big book. It's an investment. It's 900 plus pages, and it moves through, it's two parallel stories, actually it's four parallel stories, because you have two main people whose lives eventually, or you hope, are going to intersect, but they're in 1984, they're in 1Q84, so there's two lives in each. So in a way it connects with string theory, it connects with, you know, contemporary physics, with this alternate reality situation, how you move in and out of that, but it's just fun and really rewarding. And what I liked about this one more than the other Murakami novels that I've read is that it has a warmth to it. It has there's a love element. There's a kind of redemption through love theme, which was surprising for me, because I found in previous Murakami novels, which can tend toward the romantic, but there's also kind of a cold edge that I have sensed in them, but that's not the case here. This is very, very warm book. I really highly recommend it. It's one of the best books I've read in a long time, and it's my current favorite Murakami novel, although I haven't read the what's the one that I want to read?
Hard-Boiled Wonderland.
Yeah, Hard-Boiled Wonderland.
Which
yeah.
happens to be my favorite.
Yeah.
And is the other one that is romantic in a... His first big success, Norwegian Wood, was very romantic, but seems very minor compared to what he wrote after that, when he really got to know his field. Hard-Boiled Wonderland, the romance doesn't conclude, but you feel as if it's going to, and it is, in the other sense of the word, his most romantic work, in that it's the one that is the most fulfilling alternate world.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that to me, that is his... Of the previous books I've read, that's also it's got some very harsh scenes in it, but it's in some ways the the softest and most welcoming. Especially, it has two different worlds. It travels between two completely different stories, and one is much harsher than the other, and it concludes with the more welcoming one.
Interesting. Well, I definitely, that's on my list. And I wanted to talk just real briefly about Wolf Hall. Did you talk about Wolf Hall last year? Yeah.
Well, I read it this year, actually.
Yeah. I read Wolf Hall, which I just really liked very much. I liked, what I liked about it, there were things about her style I wasn't crazy about, too many pronouns, but I really liked very much the degree of research and the kind of compelling and convincing characterization in that book. So if you really
want... To be fair about the pronouns, it wouldn't have been any clearer if she had used their actual first names. They were all named Thomas.
Yeah, that's true. All these Thomases. That's true. All the Thomases. But it's a wonderful book. It's nice to read a book about Henry VIII where he's a peripheral character. But the portrait of him, I think it's very good. The portrait of Thomas Cromwell is outstanding, and the characters are really good. So if you want a good historical novel, it tied in really well with what I was doing when I was researching Richard III, because it's, you know, Richard III is killed at the end of the play by Henry VIII's dad, who is the Earl of Richmond, who becomes Henry VII, and who is the real villain in history, but we don't want to go off into all of that. But the real villain... And that whole story is not Richard III. It is definitely Henry Tudor, otherwise known as Henry VII.
And he was a really unpleasant man.
And, yeah, no kidding. So, but, you know, the whole thing of Thomas More and the whole slant, it's, you know, history is written by those who win.
Absolutely. In that book, everything you've ever read about them, Thomas More is the hero. And it was really fun to see a book about Cromwell, who's always the villain,
right,
being the hero of his own story.
Right. Yeah, it was very good. And that said?
I'm very interested to see what she does with Robespierre. Oh,
is
that what she's
doing? Is that the next one?
That's the one I just got.
Oh, interesting. Well, I know she's writing a sequel to Wolf Hall as well, which would probably go from the end of where it leaves off up through the Balin thing and his losing his head. Yeah, the Greys, that whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah. The one I gave Cameron is an earlier historical novel. She's tended to switch between an historical novel and a contemporary one and a historical one. And this one I think is called A Country of Greater Peace, something close to that, by Hilary Mantel. And it apparently revolves around Danton, Robespierre, and de Molin, who are all friends as poor young lawyers on the West Bank.
And that
doesn't last. follows them from about 1775 to the end of the Terror.
I was having a conversation with a friend who was being very derogatory toward the film Iron Lady with Meryl Streep. He does not want to see Iron Lady because he feels that he does not want to see Margaret Thatcher humanized. And my question to him was, well, what do you think she is, if not human? Do you really feel more comfortable thinking of her as some kind of magical chimera? But, you know, to me, reading these books, it's so much more fascinating to see authors struggle with the humanity of people who have been largely portrayed as unsympathetic, as monstrous kind of historical figures, to really get into why they were doing what they were doing. Many people were trying to do something that they thought was actually going to be effective for the better good of man, which was misguided and horrifying in its execution. But I think it's really fascinating to see when authors can get in there and struggle with the humanity of the monsters of history.
Right, right. No, it's a very good point. Mm-hmm. Very good point. Josephine Tay, Daughter of Time, started it all. Then the redemption of Richard III. That's me, over and out.
Okay, on to Allison.
Okay, we're doing the shifting seats here. I'm going to talk about a variety of books. I usually read the books that are, talk about the books that are newer, and so that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start with one that's getting a lot of acclaim called The Art of Fielding by Chad Harbach. First-time novelist, centers around a small college in Wisconsin on the shores of Lake Michigan, where Herman Melville has once visited, and many aspects of the story parallel that of Moby Dick, and the college mascot for one is the Harpooners, and a lot of this book is about baseball. One of the characters has patterned his life
after this book written by a famous shortstop called The Art of Fielding. And this is his mantra. Everything about him deals with baseball. And he is a great character. He's a young farm boy who is becoming a star until one game when it all goes wrong. The other main characters are his gay roommate, the president of the college, the catcher for the baseball team, who feels it's his job to transform the players into their potential at the risk of his own life. And then the daughter of the university president. And their lives all intermesh. The story revolves around baseball. I do not like baseball. Baseball bores me. But baseball here is a metaphor for life. And the writing here is just superb. As a first-time novelist, I think it's done so well. The characters are fully realized, and I really cared about all of them. It's a pretty long book, and I read it on vacation, and it worked as a beach book in Hawaii, and it would work by a fireplace, and it's just a really fine read.
I have to throw in that I don't know of a baseball novel that isn't really an allegory.
I agree.
Of something else. John did mention one.
Yeah.
But it's by Frank DeFord, who's a baseball columnist and commentator. So it might be fun to read one just since I do like baseball. Yeah. It might be fun to read one that is.
Michael Chabon wrote a really fun book about baseball and kind of in the sci-fi parallel universe. Actually, a young adult novel. But I loved that as well.
What's that called?
I can picture it, but I cannot.
It's not Summerland?
It is. Okay. It is Summerland. You know, and again, parallel universe, and where it's all about baseball. Really fun novel as well. And just because it's written for young adults doesn't mean it's not a fun book for adults to read. Next book is a book that's just gotten lots and lots of press as well. So I'll just talk about it briefly, but I did love it. It's The Tiger's Wife by Taya Obrick. And she is a novelist who is younger than my daughter and just outstanding. I first read this excerpt of the novel in the New Yorker when they do their 40 under 40 author issue where of short stories, and it centers around the time right after a civil war in an unnamed Balkan country. She is from the former Yugoslavia, so you can take that as you will. And the main character is a young doctor who is on a health mission to inoculate children in the countryside, basically in the area that had formerly been in their country after the war had ended. And it intertwines with folk tales that her grandfather told her as she was growing up, tales about his life supposedly, but with an air of magical realism. And one of the stories is about the man who couldn't die, and another about the tiger's wife. And all of these stories interweave and become part of the contemporary fabric of this. She's a really terrific author. I'm anxious to see what she will be doing next. One of my real favorite books, and this is one nobody has heard of, it was called What You See in the Dark. It's by Manuel Munoz. It's set in Bakersfield in 1962. It's a little quiet town that there's absolutely no reason to go to. It is before Highway 99 has been built. In fact, it's starting to be constructed during the story. People there are pretty much stuck in town, but close enough to Los Angeles, and they have Hollywood dreams. And one day, a famous actress and a director arrive into town. They are never named. But their story starts to the story that they are filming starts to parallel some of the stories of the characters in the book. Once you get into the novel, you know right away what film it will be, and he actually takes you through one of the most famous murder scenes of any film ever. It takes place in a small motel in a small dusty town. Just really a fun read. I loved it. There's a lot of menace in this book, but a lot of tenderness. The characters are well done. And Bakersfield is the main character of the book. And that was it. Just, he's really evoked the time and place. I just wasn't ready for this book to end. I actually kept reading the last page 3 times just to savor it all. A really fun read, sad at times, but just a great book to read.
Another fun book, My New American Life by Francine Prose. I have loved some of her books, and I have hated some of her books, and this one I really enjoyed. The main character is named Lula. She's an illegal Albanian immigrant living in New Jersey. She is a nanny to a really, melancholy teenager who doesn't need a nanny and is even more melancholy father. She is sassy. She's sad. She's pretty charming, and she's very self-deprecating. And one day she gets involved with these Albanian guys who just show up at her house, three Albanians, and her life kind of moves off into theirs. It's just a fun, crazy read. She talks a lot about her life in communist Albania, and then when the quote-unquote good guys come, and it's not so good then either. I really enjoyed the book. Historical fiction, because we were just talking about that. I've got two there. Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, I believe you would pronounce it. It's by David Mitchell, who is a very fine writer. It takes place in 1799, 100 years after Clavel's Shogun takes place, also in feudal Japan, but it's starting to change. And it's all set on a small artificial island in the middle of Nagasaki Harbor. And this island is basically where the foreigners ply their trade, but they aren't allowed to leave. It's pretty much a prison, and the Japanese don't really come there either. It's about devious merchants and the foreigners who work there. There's earthquakes and typhoons, and Jacob is a young Dutch clerk from the East India Company who comes to work there trying to raise enough money so he can marry his fiancée in 5 years' time, who is back in the Netherlands. It is a really foreign world. It's a really interesting and compelling story. There's nothing black and white. The good guys are often bad. The bad guys are often good. It's not an easy book to crack, like we were talking about some of the others, but it's definitely rewarding once you get there. Another one I liked a lot is Caleb's Crossing by Geraldine Brooks. Earlier, before we turned on the podcast, we were talking about The Pilgrim. And this is set in the time of the Puritans in New England. It takes place on an island that later became Martha's Vineyard. And Geraldine Brooks writes historical fiction, and she takes a small aspect of history that really exists and turns it into a full-blown novel. And in this case, she takes this snippet of a fact about a young Native American man who graduates from Harvard College in the 1660s. And she builds this entire story around him. It is narrated by a young girl growing up on the island whose father is a minister, whose job it is to convert the natives to Christianity. I really like this book. I think it's her best book since Year of Wonders, which is my favorite, even though she won the Pulitzer in between for March. I think this is definitely worth reading.
I never read Year of Wonders, but I liked March very much.
Yeah, Year of Wonders is about the plague, and it was a book that I didn't want to read. My book group had chosen it.
It was wonderful.
Back when my book group actually read books, and I loved it. I thought I was just totally engaged
by
this story.
It's one of my favorite books ever.
Yeah, and who would think, you know, that you would actually enjoy a book about the plague? And I did. Anybody's going to be traveling soon and wants to read a really gritty, dirty mystery, not dirty in a sexy way, but dirty and just...
Grimy.
It really is. It's Galveston by Nick Pizzolatto. Ooh. Really fun novel, mystery. Quite violent at times. It's about an ex-con who's on the run from both the law and from his former employer. Along the way, he meets a teenage prostitute and her young sister and all of these down-and-out characters who hang out in a cafe in Galveston. Roy Cade is the protagonist, and he's a really great anti-hero. He narrates his own story from the perspective of several years later, looking back on when his past is catching up with him. It's not a perfect book by any means, but what I really liked about this book was he knew how to end it, and the ending is really great. And I don't think a lot of authors do know how to end their books. And that's my biggest complaint when I'm reading something that I really love. And then it starts to taper off and taper off and taper off to a point that leaves you really unsatisfied. And this does not do that.
Now, I've noticed you left off two of the books on your list.
I was going to get to it.
Oh, good. I know sometimes you begin to feel that you're talking too much. This one?
Oh, yeah, that's the only one. I think, that's it. And I left that to the end because it is nonfiction. It's The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot. I was really blown away by this book. It is about a woman, a young, poor black woman from Virginia, and then later moves to Baltimore, Maryland, where she suffers from cervical cancer. And her cells are taken from her during her surgery without her knowledge or consent, her cancerous cells, which was done pretty routinely back then at Johns Hopkins Hospital where she was. They were trying to grow cancer cells, and it had never worked. And without having the cancer cells existing in a laboratory, they couldn't do research on how to treat cancer. And her cells became immortal. They were the first ones to grow successfully. The man in the lab, the doctor who did this, gave them away for free to any lab interested in working with them. They are alive today. They are known as HeLa, and anybody who's ever studied medicine or worked in biological sciences knows all about HeLa cells. They are responsible for the development of polio vaccine, pretty much anything to do with cancer, treatments, viruses, also in vitro fertilization, and gene mapping. One of the reasons I was so enthralled with this book is my husband suffers from a genetic mutation that has caused cancer. And it's fascinating in the science, and it's really accessible. She makes it very easy to understand. At the same time, we learn all about Henrietta's family, who are destitute. They cannot afford health insurance while their mother's genes and cells are being used to further medicine around the world. They don't even know about it until 20 years later. So there's a lot about ethics, it's a lot about science, and it's about the human story and the human condition. I cannot recommend this book enough. If you have no interest in science, it's still fascinating. If you have no interest in ethics, those stories are still fascinating. It's just, it's heartbreaking, it's inspiring.
If you have no interest in ethics, you're not a reader, you're a banker.
Right, exactly. There is that. But it's a heartbreaking story. It's really inspiring, and I found myself very, very grateful to her for her contribution, because we all know so many people who are alive today or who benefited firsthand from her contribution to science, although she never knew it. And those are my books.
Okay. Do you want to stick around and listen to us?
I would love to, but we're doing Hanukkah tonight, and I have more cooking to do because that's all I've done this week.
But I love the cooking.
Yes, well, I'm getting a little tired, so I have to go grocery shopping. So I will listen when you're on the podcast.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Eric. Okay, Cameron.
Allison's turn. Thank you, Allison.
Thank you. I have so little to discuss.
Because you have two small children and a job.
I do. I have them.
Yes. Pretty impossible to read when you do that.
So I was going over the books that I've read in the past year, and I can recommend so very few of them. What I actually most enjoyed reading this year, or rather rereading, was True Grit. That is a fantastic novel, and one of those novels that actually I think defies the recent genreification of literature. I think today, if somebody wrote True Grit, it would be subjected to the back corner of the young adult fiction shelf, or maybe the back corner of the Western fiction shelf. But the story of this girl and her very serious adventure in trying to avenge the death of her father is so well told in this short, slim book through the voices of Maddie and Rooster Coburn and Mr. LaBeef. This book also features perhaps the very best courtroom scene I have ever seen in any piece of literature ever. That courtroom scene just really brings to life what it's actually like, even today, in a criminal courtroom with the defense counsel trying to take apart the testimony of the law enforcement officer who is the arresting and reporting officer. But the whole thing from beginning to end, the manner in which Maddie narrates her story, the manner in which each of the characters comes to life, is such a wonderful thing to reread. Even if you've seen the movie 100 times, even if you read the book 10 years ago, it's a great thing to come back and revisit.
And there are quite a few Charles Portis fans out there. I didn't realize this until the movie True Grit brought his name back into common vision again. But as soon as people started talking about it, other people would say, oh, I like this other one even better. I can't think of the other titles right now.
And neither can I at the moment, because I, of course, did not come with any written materials with me. But I do intend to pick up his other novels, because, you know, just seeing the movie again and rereading that book, it reminds me of why I love to read. That's one of those books that just brings it all back. Which was good for me, because I read several books this year that reminded me why sometimes reading is an irritation. One of the other books that I really enjoyed, and expected to enjoy, quite frankly, was the latest in the Song of Ice and Fire series by George R.R. Martin, the much-awaited and anticipated A Dance with Dragons, which is the 5th book in the trilogy. And I think it's going to swell up to 7 before he manages to really wrap this thing up. There is, of course, now an HBO series, which has covered the 1st book and is wonderful. It really did a very good job. The only complaint that I have about it is that the people in Essos are way, way too clean. The Horse Lords and their folks are too tidy. But otherwise, I think they've done a very good job of covering what this book is about. I had a friend who started to read them and got 150 pages into the 1st book before putting it down in frustration, saying, the names aren't fantastic enough for fantasy. There's too much blood. And I had to remind her that these books aren't so much sword and sorcery books as they are sort of an alternate historical fiction dealing with late medieval, early Renaissance European history in a reimagined format with dragons and some supernatural things. But the dragons are really a very small part. I just really love his writing, his
and,
research.
And does this
as
one
well.
Stand up?
It does, for the most part. I think what happened is that he had this envisioned as a trilogy, and he's still trying to get to the 3rd book. He hasn't quite. He went to write that 3rd book from his own telling of it, and found that it skipped too much. So he's giving a lot of the bridge story in these interim books.
But he has started on the...
He has started multiple times on how he's going to wrap up all of these storylines. But there are a lot of characters. If you're a fan of Russian 19th century novels, you'll have no problem with it. If you're not, you're going to be very happy about the fact that in the back there are long lists of tables that kind of explain the relationship of several of the characters. And there's a very enthusiastic wiki page that has covered a lot of the backstory, so that if you have lost track of it in the decades since the 1st book came out, you can go back and get things sorted out in your head very quickly. Those were really the 2 books that I most enjoyed reading this year. I have a couple of books that I have started and put down. I intend to finish the biography of Cleopatra by Stacy Schiff, though I am incredibly frustrated with it at the moment.
How come?
I think she has taken on an incredibly fascinating character and does not know how to make what is fascinating about Cleopatra come to life on the page. What I've noticed about the book is that she brings a lot of detail about the history of the Ptolemies, about the salacious gossip, about the speculation throughout the contemporary world of the time regarding the relationship between Cleopatra and Caesar. But everything that is layered into the first half of this book really throws into relief how absent the person Cleopatra is from the narrative so far. She keeps setting the stage, but the main player has not yet arrived.
It could be she doesn't want to speculate.
It could be, but that makes it very, very difficult. And I'm not sure if it's like the historical fiction that I read, Wolf Hall and the reimaginings of medieval history, that I've become more comfortable with people just making things up.
But those are avowedly fiction. And
right, well, and even things like Colleen McCullough's First Man in Rome series and I, Claudius, where they really do go to the trouble of creating the dialogue of these fascinating historical figures. This has not happened so far. The stage is set for these major conversations, this meeting between Cleopatra and Caesar, this fantastic moment when she rolls out of her humble sack and has been smuggled into her own palace to meet the Roman general. And then they skip to the next scene.
And it's not in a rug, it's in a sack.
Right. So it is frustrating to me that we're kind of touching all the bullet points that we know already about Cleopatra's history, and nothing is illuminated. The spark is missing so far. Also, I'm a little irritated with her because she as well-researched as Stacey Schiff can create her writing, there are some little inconsistencies. The fact that at the time, the mythological world and the historical world were still sort of blurred for a lot of contemporary Alexandrians and Romans, such that you could go to places and visit pieces of Orpheus's lyre. It was like a saintly relic of the time. And she mentions the egg from which Zeus's mother hatched, which just troubled me because Zeus's mother, of course, is Rhea, and the right. egg in Sparta that she's talking about is the egg from which Helen hatched, and Helen was, according to some sources, Zeus's daughter. But it's that kind of thing where if you're going to include the detail for those people who are interested in such minutiae, you better be accurate. So that's been a little frustrating.
And I'll have to admit that I really enjoyed her biography of Vera Nabokov, called Vera. But even there, in many cases, Nabokov himself was more alive on many pages than Vera was.
Mm-hmm.
That's partly was her own deliberate intention to stay in the background and devote her life to him. But you wind up not sure if you really know her, and then realize that's probably the way she wanted it.
Right. She was an amanuensis.
Yeah.
And that takes on its own kind of character of sublimating your whole life into the narrative of other fiction for your, for lack of a better term, master. But that's all I've really got in terms of recommendations. Otherwise, I could complain more about other books, and I don't think anyone wants to hear that.
Okay. Well, I will continue with mine, and if you don't mind sticking around, I'd feel more comfortable with a second person here.
I would be happy to.
But if we start hearing howling toddlers in the background and
now,
Cameron has...
they are very enthusiastic. Well, one of them is a very enthusiastic reader.
If Cameron has to disappear, you'll know why. I never read any book or almost never read any book except maybe one on politics or history when it first comes out. In the case of novels in particular, there are so many flashes in the pan, books that get great reviews and then a couple of years later are unreadable. So I wait those couple of years. And so I've read more fiction. I have more fiction on my list this year than ever before. Almost all the books I've got, all but two. And I'll go through those as well as I can. I'm going to go through in the order I read them in, rather than the order, the historical order. The first is Who Will Run the Frog Hospital by Laurie Moore, which I believe it's one of her earlier novels, maybe her first. It starts out with an absolutely horrible framing story. I almost didn't continue after a few pages of it, but it very quickly shifts to the reminiscences of the woman in the framer, whose name is Barry Carr, who, when she was a teenager in upstate New York, had a friend named Sills, and they worked frequently as summer employees in an amusement park in that area on the upper, near the Hudson River, near Lake Champlain. And the central part is very short. It's the really most of the 150-page novel is the central part. And it gave me insight into something I thought I knew nothing about, which is teenage girls in the 1970s. I told you my mind is not working too well. And that part is fascinating. The characters are lively. The adventures are improbable, but not so. I could actually imagine several of my high school friends having done the same things 15 years before. And as a short introduction to a way of life that is completely gone now, I think there were obvious similarities between the late 50s and the mid 70s. By now, I think electronics and early adolescence have rendered that probably a forbidden past. I shouldn't say forbidden, I guess I could just say irretrievable past.
The world is so different now.
The world is so different now. The second book is Aldous Huxley's After Many a Summer Dies the Swan, which people describe as his Hollywood movie or his William Randolph Hearst, I said movie, I told you, his Hollywood novel or his Hearst novel. I read a lot of Huxley as a teenager, Brave New World first, but then I read his earliest novels, Anna Kay, Chrome Yellow, Point Counterpoint, and as anyone would know who's read any of those books, 17-year-olds wouldn't get them at all. I'm going to have to completely reread them. In the last 10 years, I've read a lot of other Huxley, mostly his more religious or philosophical things like The Perennial Philosophy, Gray Eminence, which is his wonderful biography of Father Joseph, who was Richelieu's right-hand man, and a near mystic, who Huxley feels betrayed his mystical calling, actually used his psychological sensitivity that he had acquired and his devotion that he had acquired as a priest for really foul political means, and his Doors of Perception and Heaven and Hell. A few years ago, I read Ape and Essence, which is another Hollywood novel, came out after Many Summer Dies the Swan. It is absolutely awful. This is one of his best, I think. All of Huxley's novels, including Brave New World, are essentially philosophical discussions. People are stuck in a particular situation, and they just start talking about it. And that's what most of Brave New World is people giving differing interpretations, mostly going along with the system, but a couple of them trying to fight it. And then you see how the people who tried to fight it ended up. It's a bleak forecast. This is much funnier, much lighter, not quite as bleak. It involves an English journalist going to work for the Hearst-like character who has a trophy young wife, Virginia, who is the archetypal bubble-headed blonde. There's a young man, Pete, who's also enamored of Virginia. And down the hill, there's a retired inventor who's made enough money to live in modest comfort while thinking and trying to preach a way of improving the world, which more through spiritual development, but it's not what you would normally think of in that way. It's a sort of human-centered, spiritual, social improvement. And he has a very cynical attitude toward the modern world. The journalist gets to be good friends with him. All of these characters interact in strange and comic ways. Then things begin to go a little funny toward the end because the Hearst character wants to be immortal and is tinkering with various animal glands and animal experimentation that will make him bring him immortality. The end is kind of comical, kind of gross, and not entirely satisfactory because he is successful and is in a certain way. And I won't go into it any more than that. Third, I finally got a... And I will say, all of these books were ones that I've had sitting on my shelf, and some of them have been there for years, and I just didn't have time to get to them. The third is The Monkey Wrench Gang by Edward Abbey, and I probably don't have to say too much about that because I imagine everybody else has read it.
I have actually not read it. It's on my shelf.
Okay. It's... about this group of echo saboteurs mm-hmm. in the Southwest. It's very funny. It's also a cliffhanger with lots of backcountry car chases, lots of astute observations on nature, society, different people, some beautiful writing, some great dialogue, and basically a lot of fun. He doesn't come out and endorse monkey wrenching, but you can't come away from it with much else. This may be one of our only hopes. And you have to admit that things have only gotten worse since he wrote this over 20 years ago. Next comes one book, one of two books I read this year, that is undeniably great. And that is Haldor Laxness's Independent People. When I first started cruising used bookstores, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, I saw this book all over the place, and I would see it in library thrift sales. And I knew that he had won a Nobel Prize, and I knew it had been a Book of the Month Club nominee. And I figured that it was in all those stores because Book of the Month Club people had gotten it and didn't like it and passed it on. And I figure he won the Nobel Prize because Scandinavians have an entree into it. He's Icelandic. So I didn't think too much of it. Then I saw a reissued edition, picked it up. It was full of praise from more recent writers. I started it. I couldn't stop. The beginning takes a few pages to get drawn into. It starts with old Icelandic mythology, with the visit of early Irish missionaries, and their conflict with Icelandic witches, and then goes on to the life of Bjartur, who's a bullheaded, not very bright sheep herder who's been working for another landlord for 18 years till he could build up the money for his own land, which he develops through hard and bad times, largely bad times, working on his own, marrying three times, having a stepdaughter and three sons, and all the people they get involved with. It's in the introduction by Brad Lighthouser. One person commented later on to Moxness how much they liked Bjartur, and he laughed and said, "But he's so stupid." And that is certainly true. He is stupid. He's bullheaded. One of his sons comes to a good end. One of them comes to a self-inflicted bad end. And the other two, okay, we hear babies in the background. So Cameron's going to have to disappear.
My apologies.
Anyway, the book is very funny, but always in a grim sort of way. Largely tragic and absolutely wonderful. Of all the books I've mentioned today, I think this and After Many a Summer Dies a Swan are the two I'm most likely to reread. The next one is J.G. Farrell's The Singapore Grip, and I read, 20 years ago, The Siege of Krishnapur, which was one of the first winners of the Booker Prize back in 1973. That was a historical novel about the sepoy mutiny in the rebellion against the British East India Company, which I liked very much, although all I can remember now is that it was a novel about the rebellion against the British East India Company. This is about the last months of British Singapore at the eve of World War II. It mostly follows two neighboring interlocking rubber tin tea magnates in Singapore. It goes a little bit onto the Malay Peninsula, but not very much. It's mostly their interaction, their children, their hangers-on, a few outsiders. There's a Chinese woman who's smuggled into Singapore, escaping from the Japanese, and it climaxes in what happens to all of them when the Japanese attack finally occurs. It's historical fiction, I think, at its best. Fairly cynical, extremely funny in places, very accurate, and it introduces you to the sort of life you otherwise would know very little about. The next novel I actually didn't take off my shelf because whenever it comes into my store, it sells almost instantly. I finally wound up ordering it, and I'm glad I did. It's Geek Love by Catherine Dunn. It's the story of the Vinooskis, a Kearney family whose parents set out deliberately to create monsters because the mother had been a geek. She would bite the heads off chickens as part of their act. You can only do that for so many years. It begins to affect your teeth and other things as well. So they start taking different chemical concoctions, come up with a whole family full of freaks. A first one is almost like a thalidomide baby with fins instead of arms, whom they turn into Arturo the Water Baby. I can't remember his full title. And he comes to dominate the whole family. There's Olympia Oli, who's the narrator, who's a hunchback dwarf, and there's a two-headed, or rather two-torsoed, Siamese twin set, Electra and Iphigenia. And this is a series of events in their carnival as it flourishes, as all of their acts except Oli's become successful, so that Oli winds up mostly as a helper in the other acts, and as Arturo eventually takes over the entire family operation. There is a sort of framing story at the beginning and the end, which I think is not as successful. It takes place in and around Portland, Oregon, after the final fall of the Vinooski Carnival, where Olympia and her mother Lil are living in an apartment building. Lil does not know that Olympia is her daughter. She's blind by now. And neither of them know that Olympia has given birth to a daughter who is entirely normal, except that she has a very small tail. The framing story involves another woman with a fascination for freaks and what goes on between Oli, this woman, Miss Lick, and Miranda, her daughter. And it's not as convincing. I think the book would have done perfectly well leaving her out. The book is written in one of those, in this stylized, mannered, arch, somewhat overwritten style that is fairly common these days. I think it's can be one of the Nabokov's worst legacies as a style. Too easy to imitate and too hard to carry off for real. And then there are an awful lot of books that were written 20, 30 years ago in similar styles that I think seem wildly inventive then and now to me are almost unreadable. There are even some books that come out that way now. Think of some recent Jonathan Lethem, Motherless Brooklyn, and Chronic City. I couldn't get into either of those, largely because of their style. They're not entirely Nabokov, but largely so. Geek Love begins, "When your mama was the geek, my dreamlets," Papa would say, "she made the nipping off of noggin such a crystal mystery that the hens themselves yearned toward her, waltzing around her, hypnotized with longing. Spread your lips, will they cluck, and show us your choppers." The same Crystal Lil, our star-haired mama, sitting snug on the built-in sofa that was Artie's bed at night, would chuckle at the sewing in her lap and shake her head. Don't piffle to the children now. Those hens ran like whiteheads. I think that pulls it off brilliantly. That indicates the style all the way through, and she somehow managed to get just to the other side of a divide that so many authors attempt, seem to reach somehow, either in the attempt or falling over on the other side, have injured themselves so badly that it destroys their work. The other day, I picked up a book that came into the store. It's a total trifle. I read it in a couple of hours and then planned to take it back to the store. I read a lot of books that way, mysteries in particular, but some straight fiction too. I'll go through it and say, oh, that was nice, but I don't need to keep it. This one I found I couldn't take back, slight as it is. It's Apostolos Doxiadis, Uncle Petros, and Golbach's Conjecture. It's clearly by a Greek novelist. It takes place, 20-some years, 20, 30 years ago. A young Greek boy has an elderly uncle he only visits once or twice a year, who mostly stays around his modest house playing chess, gardening, and thinking. He somehow discovers that his uncle was once a famous mathematician, and by a bit of a deceit, finds out what his uncle's life work was, which was Goldbach's Conjecture. He wrote a letter to Leonhard Euler, the great 18th century Swiss mathematician, suggesting that any even number above 2 was the sum of prime. And no one has been able to prove it since then. And Uncle Petros devoted his best mathematical years to trying to prove it. And the attempt totally changed his life, and you could say destroyed it. You could say just derailed it, but derailed it in a way that he could never get back on a conventional track again. And I might very well reread it in a year just to refresh myself on the mathematics or on some of the insight it throws on several of the other characters who pass through briefly, including mathematicians around Cambridge University in the mid-teens and early 20s, G.H. Hardy, and especially the Indian savant mathematician Ramanujan, and then later on Kurt Gödel, Alan Turing, and a few of others. It's a light read and a lot of fun. And then I also had a Shakespeare book, and it's too bad that now I'm the last person. This one was Shakespeare's Wife by Germaine Greer. It came out a number of years ago, and Greer actually began her adult life as a literary scholar. She's an expert on Elizabethan theater. Most of her works have been more polemical, starting with The Female Eunuch, but she knows this field, I would say, as well as anybody, and her observations are very astute. She basically is looking at Shakespeare's life, everything that happened in it, from the point of view of Anne Hathaway, why they may have gotten married in the first place, with her being older and he being younger. She points out that this was not that uncommon, and that many women who didn't marry until their mid-20s, and that she was probably the better catch, that it wasn't a matter of him marrying sort of on the rebound of her entrapping him and becoming pregnant after an earlier love had faded, but of the Hathaways were a family on the rise. The Shakespeares seemed to be in decline at this time, and she was a very good catch, and he may have actually had to work quite hard to get her. But that his, in addition, his theatrical connections that took him to London may have largely come through her friends or her family friends, and her family had more connections in London as well. And then goes on to mention the fact that the new place in, well, there are quite a few things in between about what they, how she could have been staying alive and all the time she was, he was gone, that she probably managed all the family property. She very likely did a lot of knitting and weaving, which was technically illegal unless you were licensed, but that a lot of people did sort of on the sly, and probably brewing as well, which is very common, and you could legally do a certain amount of, and that these businesses were prospering much better than John Shakespeare's gloving business, that she may well, and she may have bought up land, and a lot of the transactions that were done in his name were largely done that way because that's how it was done. Women did not have the same property rights that men did, but they quite often did the management of it. And the new place, the large house in Stratford that they bought at about the time that he became prosperous, as Greer points out, was not a model house when it was bought. It was quite run down. It had been damaged in plagues and fires and involved a great deal of rebuilding. And it may have been a good place for her extended family, as and indeed it was, as well as for him and her to live in when he was in Stratford. She points out that many of the sonnets could have been written to her, that the attitude in the plays people point out as being quite misogynistic. This is somewhat true. And a little earlier in the day, we were talking about Coriolanus and how much of it relates to the actions of Coriolanus's mother and wife. It really revolves around that. And if you look at it a little more closely, you realize that Coriolanus's mother is a rather cold, imperious, domineering person. And it's his wife who is the warm, loving one. And Greer points out that this is the case in almost all of Shakespeare's plays. The mothers tend to be quite unlovable, and the wives tend to almost always, with the possible exception of Lady Macbeth, be the redeeming characters in their husbands' lives. She then goes on to talk about quite a few other things. It can get a bit tedious at times because she goes into great detail about the financial and property lives of all the people involved, who lent money to whom. And again, many of the transactions that are in Shakespeare's name were probably ones that Anne actually made. She also makes a very good point about the numerous lawsuits of the time. People began to feel that Shakespeare became super litigious late in life. But she points out that there was no banking system, there was no circulating banknotes, and basically what people relied on were letters of credit and IOUs, which would be exchanged back and forth. And sometimes lawsuits were the only clearinghouse if people couldn't agree, and if a IOU had passed hands several times, who the rightful owner was and who actually should pay whom came into doubt. And that minor lawsuits happened all the time just as a way of settling small contentions that would not have been necessary if there had been banks or better transportation, because a lot of these IOUs went on between, say, Stratford and London. And finally, she gives a long chapter, which is can be very tedious also because the topic is, did Shakespeare die of syphilis? She won't say absolutely yes, but she goes into a strong analysis of how Elizabethan and Jacobean's physicians and common folk saw syphilis, its symptoms, and its effects, and demonstrates that William Shakespeare seemed to show many of these symptoms at that time, which makes it a pretty good chance that he was.